From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A surprise announcement from the FBI this morning. Director James Comey making a televised appearance to say that while Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while Secretary of State was careless, it was not criminal, and he recommends no charges be filed. Let's give a little bit of a listen.
Although there is evidence of potential violations of the statutes regarding the handling of classified information, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. Prosecutors necessarily weigh a number of factors before deciding whether to bring charges. There are obvious considerations like the strength of the evidence, especially regarding intent. Responsible decisions also consider the context of a person's actions and how similar situations have been handled in the past. In looking back at our investigations into the mishandling or removal of classified information, we cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts. All the cases prosecuted involved some combination of clearly intentional and willful mishandling of classified information, or vast quantities of information exposed in such a way as to support an inference of intentional misconduct, or indications of disloyalty to the United States, or efforts to obstruct justice. We do not see those things here.
A lot to unpack there. Let's start our coverage with NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, it seems like the headline there is that there is no recommendation of charges being brought in this case.
Yeah, Jeremy, this was so unusual for so many reasons, one of which is that within the FBI, it's very rare for the FBI director to open up an investigation of this sort to this level of scrutiny, public scrutiny. And it seems clear James Comey did so because he was quite concerned about a perception of impropriety or political interference. He says there was none. But he went step by step, Jeremy, and talked about the painstaking efforts FBI agents have taken in the last year to not just understand what happened with that one server, private server, Hillary Clinton had in her home in Chappaqua, New York, when she was Secretary of State, but multiple devices, including multiple BlackBerries. The FBI director said this investigation kind of felt like somebody taking a jigsaw puzzle that was put together and dropping all the pieces on the ground, and the federal agents had to put the pieces back together
and
all
read
over again.
30,000 emails. He said the FBI read all of the emails.
All of the emails and reconstructed some other emails that had been – all of the emails Hillary Clinton turned over to the State Department and reconstructed other emails that had been deleted, not for nefarious purposes, but just in the course of normal deletion to clean up your account. He said there was no obstruction of justice here, but the agents went through thousands and thousands of messages, ultimately finding 110 emails were classified at the time they were sent or received, including 8 email chains that were top secret at the time, Jeremy.
Well, Carrie, let's hear a little bit more about what he said about those emails that you're discussing. This is, I think, when he was referring to Clinton and her staff being extremely careless. Let's listen.
From the group of 30,000 emails returned to the State Department in 2014, 110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. 8 of those chains contained information that was top secret at the time they were sent. 36 of those chains contained secret information at the time. And 8 contained confidential information at the time. That's the lowest level of classification.
Well, Carrie Johnson, explain to those listening who might be thinking, well, wait a second, that sounds bad. You know, why are there no charges? Why are there no charges given that?
Well, Robin, the FBI director said that Clinton and her aides were extremely careless in their handling of information. But given the statutes on the books, one that involves willful or intentional mishandling of classified information and another that involves negligence and a review of prior cases in which people had been charged, FBI Director Comey said no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case against Clinton or her aides. So the intent wasn't there, but the FBI certainly found that Clinton and her aides had been extremely careless, and that overall, the culture at the State Department in terms of security was extremely lax, in his view, extremely lacking.
Is there a difference between whether something is classified and when it is marked classified? Because Clinton has said in the past that she didn't send anything that was marked classified at the time, but can't things be classified without being marked classified?
Absolutely, Jeremy. And the FBI director more or less said he wasn't buying that line from Hillary Clinton that she's been selling for over a year now. That said, even though he found no evidence of criminal misconduct here, he said in other cases in the past there might be some kind of security or administrative sanctions where government officials would have had their security clearance yanked or some kind of lesser punishment. That was not the question the FBI was looking at here. The FBI was looking at the central question of any possible criminal misconduct in this matter.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, we're going to ask you to stand by there for a second because, of course, this is just reverberating across the campaign spectrums. We've got NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro with us. Domenico, Donald Trump is already tweeting about this.
Yeah, he's saying FBI director said crooked Hillary compromised our national security. No charges. Wow. Hashtag rigged system.
Yeah. So tell us how it's reverberating.
Well, you just read one of Donald Trump's tweets. He also tweeted that the system is rigged. General Petraeus got in trouble for far less. Very, very unfair, as usual, bad judgment. So, you know, this is a case that he's been making. It's a case that conservatives have been making. It was a pretty harsh press conference from Director Comey. I think a lot of people expected that there wouldn't be an indictment, but I don't know that they expected that kind of a lashing at Secretary Clinton for being extremely careless. And that is just going to reinforce the notion that Hillary Clinton is untrustworthy with the segment of the population that believes that. She's really struggled, and this has hung over her candidacy and will likely continue to do so.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit of what he said about that distinction between something that's criminal and something that's careless.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
But Domenico, remind us what the Clinton campaign has said about this in the past, about other secretaries of state using their email servers in the same way.
She has noted that, but her story has kind of shifted a bit since in the last year and a half or so. She moved toward what you were talking about with Carrie, that she had said that that she didn't send or receive anything that was marked classified. Mm-hmm. And Director Comey, said that they should know better, that there were several emails that were classified, including some that were top secret, and that they should have known the subject matter. And political matter. I mean, to be fourth in line to the president, you know, President Obama is not allowed to have his own private email. The government essentially takes it over because it can't be secured. And Director Comey said that given that Clinton had sent stuff in countries of adversaries, that there is a possibility that her email was viewed by adversarial countries and people that were not friends of the United States. You know, it's a move that is really not smart and was kind of paranoid from the beginning to have to try to do something like that. Really puts the onus on you for security because yes, .gov email addresses have certainly been hacked in the past and are not considered secure, but it's the government that's at fault, not you personally.
Domenico, when you take this and put it in the context of all of the other things that are going on in the campaign right now, ISIS, building a wall, income inequality, everything else, how important is this going to be now heading into the general election, which is looks like it'll be between Clinton and Trump?
Well, it is going to be between Clinton and Trump. But if you were to remove this story from Hillary Clinton, think about the difference in the narrative that would exist for her candidacy. But it is these kinds of unforced errors that we continue to see from both candidates and part of the reason why both of them are the most unliked probable nominees in history, with Donald Trump being even worse liked. Hillary Clinton certainly, you know, deeply rooted in policy, and was going to try to run on some of those things as opposed to what Donald Trump has tried to push forward. But this certainly is a huge distraction from the kinds of policy and substantive issues that she'd rather be running on.
Yeah. And I wouldn't, Carrie Johnson, are you still there?
I'm here.
Well, NPR's justice correspondent, just remind us what happens next, because we remember the news of last week where Attorney General Lynch said she would let this decision stand.
Robin, so the Justice Department will accept this recommendation from the FBI director. And it's very hard to imagine in this environment, on this time frame, that the Justice Department would somehow overrule the FBI, which has determined that no reasonable prosecutor would bring any charges in this case. That said, I think there's going to be a lot of debate moving forward in both legal and political circles about the nature of this investigation and whether it came out the right way.
And Domenico, it certainly sucks the air out of the other news story that was going to be big today, which is that President Obama is campaigning with Hillary Clinton.
Well, or you could look at it the other way, where that they're actually coming after this announcement. I'm sure they would have preferred this announcement be on a Friday afternoon rather than on a Tuesday morning. But that said, it is a significant moment that you're going to see with Barack Obama on stage with Hillary Clinton, because it'll be the first time in at least 100 years, the start of a president campaigning strongly with his chosen successor. In the past, we've had presidents who are unpopular, like George W. Bush, who didn't really campaign at all for John McCain. Bill Clinton, Al Gore distanced himself from him after the Lewinsky scandal. And Ronald Reagan, the most that he wound up doing for George H.W. Bush was to hold a fundraiser and called him George Bush in that fundraiser toward the end of his presidency.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. We also were speaking with NPR justice correspondent Carrie Johnson about the news today that the FBI recommends no criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. You guys, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
If you were out watching fireworks last night, you may have missed this. Just before midnight Eastern time, NASA got word that its spacecraft Juno had made it successfully into Jupiter's orbit, about 540 million miles away. Kelly Beattie is senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. He joins us by Skype. And Kelly, I've seen this called by the principal investigator Scott Bolton at NASA the hardest thing NASA has ever done. Why is that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. It's not so much getting it into orbit, because that's something that NASA's gotten pretty good at. First is that Jupiter's a long way away, and the sunlight there is only about 4% as strong as it is here on Earth. Now, other spacecraft that have gone out that far have used plutonium as their power source. Juno, by contrast, is using these gigantic solar panels, and it makes it a very big spacecraft, about the size of a basketball court. Hmm. And so it's hard to control something that big. That's one thing. The other is that by its very mission, Juno is going to be probing very deeply into the lethal radiation belts that surround Jupiter. And in fact, they'll probably ultimately be the end of the spacecraft. So we want to find out about those radiation belts. But in order to make a spacecraft function when it's getting millions of times a lethal dose of what would be for a human, you know, that's a challenge too.
I spoke with the Juno project scientist, Stephen Levin, yesterday, and he told us that Juno's scientific instruments were all turned off for its descent into Jupiter's orbit, and that they won't be turned on and begin transmitting the first scientific data for another 53 days. So do we even know at this point if those instruments are working?
So, you know, now that it's safely in orbit, there'll be a kind of a checkout where they check in with each of the instruments to make sure that they are, in fact, functioning. The reason he said that was that the orbit is not circular, as you might think, but it's this really long cigar-shaped thing. Hmm. And it only gets very close to Jupiter once every 53 days. And that won't be, again, until August 27th. So only then will most of those instruments be able to do their thing. And so consequently, we'll have to wait a little while, a couple of months, until we get the first real science back from Juno.
And what Stephen Levin was telling us was that we are not going to just learn about Jupiter. We're going to learn about ourselves in a way, and the formation of a lot more than just Jupiter. What are the big questions that you have, Kelly Beattie, about Jupiter that you'd like to learn from Juno?
Yeah, so there's three, really. The first is, does the planet have a core? Now, you would think that, like Earth, Jupiter should have a core, and we think it does, but we have no way to actually go inside this enormous planet that's, you know, 100,000 miles across to see what's inside. By tracing the spacecraft's trajectory, we'll be able to map its gravity and from that get a sense of whether there's a big mass concentrated at its center or spread out. That's one. Second thing is, where's the water? Water should be very common on Jupiter, as it is here on Earth, even more so on Jupiter. And yet, our prior attempts to measure it have come up dry, literally dry. And so Juno has a way to look deep down into the planet and try to map the water that's there. The third is these radiation belts. We see these spectacular auroras on Jupiter, and we want to get that connection between the particles in the magnetosphere and the aurora to see what really the connections are.
When you talk about the possibility of water content, that brings us to another very interesting point that Stephen Levin made, which was that this spacecraft, Juno, at the end of its mission is going to make a suicide mission, basically, and destroy itself in the atmosphere. But they have to be very careful about that because of this. Here's Stephen Levin.
We want to make extra sure that we don't contaminate Jupiter's moons, in particular Europa, which has a liquid water ocean underneath its ice, because you'd hate 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now to get to Europa, dig beneath the ice, sample the liquid water ocean, find life, and then have to say, I don't know if this is life from Europa or contamination from Juno a long time ago.
Kelly, he said that's a small possibility, but a risk that's just not worth taking.
Right, because, you know, back in the day, NASA used to sterilize the spacecraft that it sent, say, to Mars. They don't do that anymore, but they use this sort of sidestepping kamikaze stuff to avoid the possibility of contamination. So we don't think there's life on Jupiter. And so by plunging the spacecraft into the planet, it safely gets it out of the way. And so any contamination will be avoided.
So for people listening to this and just fascinated by this mission, what's the next thing that they can look forward to with Juno?
I think the first thing they should do is go outside on any clear night in the next couple of weeks and look toward the southwest after sunset. Jupiter is there. And you can imagine that the spacecraft is streaming back all this data that's just flooding all over you. If you could pick it up, you'd be able to see what's going on. But in terms of Juno itself, we're really going to check out the spacecraft and wait a couple of months until that first close pass, just about 2,500 miles above the cloud tops, to get some real data back.
Is it a coincidence that we can see Jupiter in the sky right now, and this is the moment when NASA wanted Juno to arrive?
It is a lovely coincidence, actually. The fact that Jupiter is visible to us right now has more to do with where Jupiter and the Earth were at the time of launch back in 2011.
That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, thanks as always.
All right, Jeremy. Take care.
And you can hear our interview with NASA project scientist Stephen Levin at our website, hereandnow.org.
Well, back on Earth, the Olympics start 1 month from today, and American athletes are finding out if they'll be going. Last week, the swim trials. This week, runners competing for spots at the track and field trials in Eugene, Oregon, or Tracktown USA, as it's known to fans. And boy, there's been triumph, but also the agony of the feet, tripping feet, as we'll hear from Tim Layden, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. And Tim, sports aficionados say the whole tryout, the week, is the best track meet in the world, maybe even more exciting than the Olympics. So is it living up to that?
Well, it's been a really good meet. It's been typical of the Olympic trials in that immediately within the first 5 minutes of the meet commencing last Friday, we had two runners eliminated from the 800 meters who were expected to make the Olympic team when they were eliminated in the first round. And also last night we had a very heartbreaking race in the women's 800 meters. But there's also been a number of very uplifting performances, and this really fits the form of the Olympic track and field trials. Unlike swimming, where you sort of see form holding throughout and a very predictable meet, track and field is really a three-ring circus and with very, very high highs and very low lows over a period of 8 days.
Well, take the low lows of the women that you mentioned in the 800-meter final last night. Tell us the story, but what do we know more about what happened?
Well, obviously one of the significant storylines going into that race was that a 32-year-old woman named Alicia Montaño had run in a number of worldwide championships, Olympics and World Championships, and had come very close to medals but had not won medals, and largely because she had been beaten by athletes who were later shown to have used performance-enhancing drugs. So there was a lot of emotional hope that Montaño would make the team and maybe have one more chance. And there was a collision on the final turn of the race, about 120 meters from the finish, and Alicia Montaño fell to the track and It's interesting because it's very sad that she didn't make the Olympic team, but at the same time, there's fairly significant video evidence that she caused her own demise with that fall, and possibly by running a tactically poor race and being just too tired at that point. And the other woman that fell, Brenda Martinez, was really the favorite in the race. And so it's sad on many levels, but also a certain degree of justice there, and that's simply the harsh reality of the sport.
Well, I mean, so Alicia Montano might have taken out Brenda Martinez. Both of them were expected to make the team. And aren't there some complaints that, hey, how can one race be the determination?
Well, that's another issue altogether. A lot of people have thought for many years that the United States should have a system where perhaps one or two athletes are selected by this pressure cooker of the Olympic trials, and maybe one or two spots held out for athletes that have shown great ability over time. For instance, that's why Usain Bolt, the great Jamaican sprinter who did not run in the Jamaican trials last weekend, will be added to their team on Thursday in both the 100 and 200 meters, simply because he's so good over time. The problem when you do that is that you inject politics and influences of certain people in an athlete's camp or a shoe company's camp, and then the situation really gets even more messy than it was last night. And I think that although it can be painful, really the one race on one night system is probably the best for the United States.
Well, and you mentioned Usain Bolt. He's injured. That's going to be a storyline we'll follow. But we want to mention Boris Berian. He, as people remember, he was sued by Nike because he wanted to run in New Balance gear. He won that case. He also made the team by finishing second last night. You have such a great line about him. You remind us that he only started all of this in 2014 because he was working at a two-person McDonald's inside a Walmart, two cords of glory days shy of leaving his potential by the side of the road forever. And yet here he is going.
And it's really a remarkable story. The great thing that Boris Berian has is talent. Really, in only 18 months, he's become one of the best 800-meter runners in the world. And now he can take that talent to Rio. And it really is a very uplifting story. And it shows that there is a place if you just stick with it and if you get with the right people. And also, he's an inspiration and a symbol to a lot of runners because he took on the giant corporation of Nike and said that this contract you have me in is not legal, and they eventually backed down and walked away, and now he does run for New Balance.
Yeah. That's Tim Layden, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. We'll link you up to his writing at hereandnow.org as he covers the Olympic track and field trials in Eugene, Oregon. Tim, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For 12 years, the struggling city of Chester, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia, has had no supermarket. So, in 2014, a local food bank set up a nonprofit grocery store in that city. Did it work? Here's Laura Benchoff of Here and Now contributor WHYY.
2.5 years ago, the Fair and Square supermarket opened to much fanfare. Chester is an old manufacturing city, just down the Delaware River from Philadelphia, where high poverty and high rates of violent crime are common. Before Fair and Square, people here had to leave the city to buy fresh food. In town, the alternative was to buy mostly processed food at corner stores. The market's produce manager, Nate Sumpter, says at first, customers didn't like much of the selection on the shelves.
Watercress, lettuce, that didn't sell too well. Leeks, that didn't go over well. Rutabagas, parsnips, that didn't go over well.
Fair and Square is laid out like an upscale grocery store. There are fresh fruits and vegetables front and center, a wall of frozen food, and a stocked deli case. The nonprofit's mission is to make the community healthier, says operations manager Mike Basher. But it doesn't mean it's a junk food-free zone.
We want to have all kinds of healthy stuff. You know, so when you come in, you're like, wow, what's all this? Plus what they're used to seeing.
To attract and keep customers, Basher and his crew started tinkering with their stock. They cleared away products that weren't selling and replaced them with things customers asked for, like more Latin American and Caribbean foods.
Like, this is a batata. It's like a potato. It's a starch. And things like mangoes, coconuts, green bananas, which are more used for cooking.
On a recent visit, a lot of people in Fair and Square's checkout line bought both packaged and fresh foods. Chocolate milk and sugary cereal slid over the scanner, along with fresh meat and bagged lettuce. But research now shows just putting healthier food on shelves doesn't guarantee customers will buy it. Ann Palmer, a food researcher at Johns Hopkins University, says that's especially true if people are worried about spending scarce dollars on something their family won't eat.
If you're on a budget, you aren't necessarily purchasing food with the intent of improving your health. You are purchasing food to satisfy hunger, and that means you might have like a lower risk level of, you know, trying new foods.
Fair and Square has been playing with ways to get customers to fill more of their carts with healthy food. Shoppers who sign up for a free membership card get money back on every bill. They also get credits when they buy fruits and vegetables. Whether they choose to buy broccoli or cinnamon buns, Fair and Square shoppers say they're grateful to have a choice in Chester. Chris and Kaisha Smith, a young married couple, say they come to Fair and Square a couple of times a week now.
They got everything.
Chicken,
steak, stuff like that. What's up, bro? They the best, though. I ain't gonna lie to you.
Chester isn't a food desert anymore, but Fair and Square needs to attract more loyal customers like the Smiths to survive. The supermarket needs to grow its sales by another 20% just to break even. For now, it's subsidized by its parent company, the food bank Philabundance. In recent years, Chester has seen both a deep discount grocery store and a members-only food co-op come and go. The folks behind Fair and Square hope they've found a sweet spot that's viable somewhere in the middle. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Britain's cultural institutions are bracing for the impact of the Brexit, the vote to leave the European Union. There was mixed news out of last week's London art sales, considered the first test. British painter Jenny Saville's Shift fetched around $9.1 million, the highest price ever for the artist's work. But overall, sales were down, many collectors holding back their best pieces. As we've been reminded, EU countries pay membership fees, which are then pooled and doled out to struggling farmers and artists in member countries. British movie makers received $145 million from the EU between 2007 and 2015. Michael Ryan, head of the Independent Film and Television Alliance, says Brexit is a major blow that could affect movie financing. And then there's dance. To find out more about that, we turn to Alistair Spalding, Chief Executive and Artistic Director of Sadler's Wells, the world-famous dance venue in London. They bring in companies from everywhere to perform on its stages and produce works that tour outside Britain. The legendary ballet star Margot Fonteyn got her first critical raves there at only 16. Alistair Spalding joins us from the BBC in London. Welcome.
Hello there. Hi.
Well, and what's been the mood in the cultural community?
I want to say terrible. It's bad. It's very depressing. It's scary. There's a lot of anger, a lot of confusion. We're in a very dark place, I have to say.
Well, first of all, explain why. I start with the funding. The EU operates much like the federal government does here in the United States. So I'm imagining that there are monies that come from the fees that member countries pay to the EU that come back to cultural institutions.
Yes, there's something called the Culture Europe Fund, and we've been successful in a couple of joint bids on that program. So over the last 5 years, we've had about €500,000 euros out of that. And of course, we're now going to be disqualified from any further applications to that project. So, it's a fiscal problem on that front, but also we then will not be so connected with our European colleagues, because these were very kind of imaginative programs looking at audience development, how we work better to make a cohesive society, these sort of things. So it wasn't just the money, it was the way we connected with people across the water.
Well, and we remind ourselves on this count too that the EU is about open borders so that workers could cross through and work in other countries. How might that affect your dance groups? Was it about dancers coming from other countries?
Yeah, it's both ways. So, I mean, dance obviously is an international language. You know, people cross borders because there's no language involved. So dance companies here are multinational. We are bringing companies from Europe and the rest of the world all the time. And we're also taking our productions around Europe all the time. So the ease of cross-border traveling is a key part of our existence. And so suddenly we're going to be plunged into a lot more bureaucracy, and I think a lot of talented dancers won't be able to come and settle in the UK.
They may have to get work permits or visas. Will that really be that much of a roadblock?
Yes, I mean, obviously, if they're just visiting to perform, then it's just another level of bureaucracy. But what I'm really talking about is people who want to come and live and work in a dance company in the UK and vice versa, because, as I say, there's an exchange of skills at the moment between Europe and the UK, and that's going to be much more difficult because then you have to apply for a leave to remain, as you would do if you were coming from any other part of the world.
Yeah. Then you've got things like the falling pound, pound losing value, fears of a recession. I'm imagining that people who are depending on people's discretionary dollars, that's got to be worrying you.
Yes, I mean, Sadler's Wells has an unusual model for the UK, so we only get 9% of our money from the state. So the rest is self-generated, and 70% of that is ticket sales. So if people start, if there's a recession, which there could well be, if people start worrying again about the pennies in their pockets, then they may decide not to come to a dance performance, and of course that affects us quite badly.
Yeah, well, it's people buying tickets, but I'm sure you also fundraise.
Yeah, it hits us every way. I mean, you know, every time there's a kind of downturn in the market, all of the corporates just stop giving. I mean, they stop investing in other things, but they definitely stop giving. That's an important, usually for us, but we're in the middle of a big project to build a third theatre out in the where the Olympics took place in Stratford in 2012. And that has a $150 million target for fundraising as a whole project. So it's not great news on that front because, you know, people are just going to be a bit more careful about what they invest and give to.
What do you say to people, though, who say, look, of all the concerns surrounding Brexit, that the farmers will no longer get their subsidies from the EU, for instance, why should we care about whether dancers are able to cross the border freely or your company gets $500,000?
Yeah, of course. There are lots of people who are going to be worried and their lives are going to be affected. My view is that culture is an incredibly important part of our way of life, and particularly in the UK, because we're very good at it. And actually, it goes beyond the stage. It goes into the work we do with communities and education. And I think that, you know, particularly in difficult times, we actually bring a sense of balance to the world and a way of thinking about things, which hopefully is an enlightened one. So I think a society without a strong cultural offer is a very, very poor one.
It's so interesting. The break is about this distrust of other countries and Britain being aligned with other countries. And you see what you do and what other artists do as sort of trying to work across those borders. But you know, we understand that 96% of people in the creative industries in Britain voted to remain or wanted to remain. But the office that oversees you, and we didn't know this, that Britain has a Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, openly supported the exit.
Yes. It doesn't quite fit those two things, does it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know our Secretary of State was for Brexit. And
it's John Whittingdale. So, John Whittingdale.
Yeah, that's right. So it's clear that what's happened here is that we amongst our, you know, colleagues in the creative industries and particularly in London have one view of life, and there's a very different view in other parts of the country. And I think that's the challenge now, is to try and bring people together and understand why they were so worried about being in the EU, why they were so worried about immigration, what their concerns are. And I think arts have a part to play now in trying to heal some of the terrible rifts. I mean, you know, I don't know if you really understand how much debate and anger there is here.
No.
It's incredible. And you will have read that there's been an increase in hate crimes recently against foreigners. And this is not something we want to go back to. This is a whiffs of the 1930s. And so I think it really is important. And frankly, we don't have a political leadership at the moment. You know, the Labour Party is in disarray as well as the Conservatives. So it's even more important for the arts to sort of step in and say, OK, we're only a minor part of all of this, but we must also try and bring people together.
Well, I'm wondering, is part of that maybe traveling with a troop to the northern part of England, to some of the devastated former shipbuilding towns, you know, that voted almost 100% to leave the EU. And people have no jobs, maybe no arts.
Yes. I mean, you know, we already take our work around the country. We were in Doncaster, which is another area where there was a Brexit vote. You know, I'm afraid that however much we do in terms of touring around and showing work, it clearly wasn't enough to convince people. We need to keep doing it, but we need to understand exactly what the limits of that are. Yes, and Sunderland, I mean, it has a theatre, it has a good, strong cultural offer, but still it's very poor and people are and they need jobs and they need some kind of meaning back in their lives. So I think this is a big issue for politicians now.
Maybe a dance or a play or a musical about that.
Yeah,
just thinking.
Sure. I think there'll be a lot of work which is coming out of this, which will try and express what people are feeling. I think that we'll see that on our stages soon.
That's Alistair Spalding, Chief Executive and Artistic Director of the dance house Sadler's Wells in London. Alistair, thank you and best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And while we're on the subject of international culture, a giant of global cinema is gone. Abbas Kiarostami, the Iranian director who won acclaim for telling stories about everyday Iranian life, has died. One of his best-known films was Taste of Cherry, the story of a suicidal man who drives through Tehran looking for someone he can pay to bury him after he dies. It won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in 1997. Other filmmakers fled Iran after the revolution. Kiarostami stayed until recently, when he made movies with Juliette Binoche in Tuscany and shot his final film, 2012's Like Someone in Love, in Japan. Abbas Kiarostami died yesterday in Paris. He was 76.
The electric car maker Tesla has had some bad news in the last week. Over the weekend, Tesla said it missed its forecast for car shipments for the second consecutive quarter, just days after it was revealed that a driver was killed while using Tesla's self-driving mode. For more, let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Edmund Lee is managing editor of Recode. He joins us now. Ed, welcome back.
Thanks.
So what's going on with Tesla?
Well, it, as you pointed out at the top here, it missed its delivery shipment for the second time this year. It was supposed to deliver, or it forecast it would deliver 17,000 vehicles, and it only delivered about 14,000 and change. So they missed about 15%. And, you know, that's actually a pretty big deal when you're a new company like Tesla trying to get more people buying its product, its car. And, you know, I think it's just going to be that much harder for the back half of the year for it to make up for that shortfall.
Any sense of why? Because it seems that there's so much excitement about every Tesla vehicle that comes out.
There is. And current Tesla owners are rabid fans of the car. So it's not for lack of interest. It's not for lack of customer interest. In fact, they're signed up all the time. There's a long waiting list for a lot of the cars. It's just good old-fashioned manufacturing issues. You know, I mean, we think of Tesla as this tech startup, which it is in a lot of ways. But the issues it's facing are issues that car manufacturers have had for decades and decades, which is supply and workers and scheduling. And it's just missing. And that's what it comes down to. It's this very old-fashioned problem.
Is there any way for them to fix it, or are we going to continue to see consecutive quarter after consecutive quarter with sales that are below expectations?
We're more likely to see the miss going forward, and that's based on the company's own projections. Their narrative around how they're developing is, you know what, we're going for the moon here. These are moonshots, right? And if we miss, it's because, you know, we're trying really hard. We're trying to hit a much higher target. So, you know, it's a weird position for a public company like Tesla to be in to make it to sort of be very upfront about that. It hasn't really figured out the manufacturing side as well as it could, the way an established company might. And so you're more likely to see, as I said, them miss these targets going forward.
And what about this fatal crash of a vehicle using the self-driving mode? First of all, what do we know at this point about exactly what happened?
We actually, unfortunately, don't know enough. The nuts and bolts of it are that a driver in Florida was killed when, you know, he was driving his Tesla using what's called their autopilot feature, which is a semi-autonomous driving mode where on a highway you can engage it and you can sort of let go of the wheel and not even do anything. It'll drive for you. What ended up happening is I think a truck from the oncoming traffic jumped the median and ended up crashing into the car. The autopilot feature apparently was not able to distinguish the truck from the road. I think the explanation that Tesla gives is because the truck was white and the background, the weather, the horizon was also white, so it couldn't differentiate. So it's a really specific problem, and it goes to show you just how far we are from real autopilot or real autonomous driving.
And I think white, by the way, is the most common color of any car. So that's going to be a problem they're going to have to deal with. What does it mean for companies, including Tesla, but also Google, that are trying to make this a reality, self-driving cars?
Well, I actually think self-driving cars will be a reality. There's so much effort and work being put into it. What's interesting about what happened in this particular crash is that there are two different approaches to autonomous driving. Semi-autonomous is what just happened with Tesla, and then fully autonomous, meaning we're going to design the car ground up to be fully autonomous. If you can put your hands on the wheel if you absolutely need to, but it's designed to do the thing that, you know, where you don't really have to touch it. Semi-autonomous is partly, whereas it's almost like, you know, cruise control in a bit plus. And I think that's in a way more dangerous sometimes, because people don't realize semi-autonomous doesn't mean autonomous, meaning you're supposed to actively be monitoring what's happening. And it's almost more stressful that way. It's actually a lot more work to monitor not just the road, but what the car's kind of doing without you attached to it. And I think that's – we want to see these two different approaches converge at some point, and that's when it's going to become an everyday reality.
And I want to quickly get your thoughts on one other big story in the world of tech. Facebook, over the weekend, Israel's public security minister criticized the social media network for, he said, failing to block posts that incite Palestinian violence. The Israelis claim that Facebook has blood on its hands in relation to several deadly attacks. What's going on here?
Harsh words, right. What's interesting is that, you know, what Facebook is experiencing is that, you know, we have to see what Facebook's product is. And it's people's expressions. That's what it really is. And that they're ultimately trying to protect that. And so it's actually really hard to take posts down because they're the ones making the determination what is and isn't hateful speech. And I think it's going to run into more problems going forward because, you know, governments and municipalities and just sort of, you know, social mores will dictate, you know, hey, why is Facebook the one, you know, making this determination? Why aren't governments doing that? Or why aren't, you know, communities doing that ultimately? And I think that's where the issue is going to be for Facebook going forward. It's only going to get more difficult for them.
And of course, when you're dealing with different governments, there are questions about whether you're doing too much to satisfy one government, which decides that language is hate speech or language shouldn't be up there. So a lot of questions for Facebook, especially because it's operating all over the world. Ed Lee, managing editor at Recode, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. We are also on Facebook, by the way, at facebook.com/Here and Now Radio. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.